Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best one-hit wonder book and or author. And to help me are my two friends, Ian and Joe, two high school English teachers.
My name's Joe Holshue, and Nick, if you're looking for a one-hit wonder book or author or something,
and I've slash got or a author.
Book yeah. and maybe an author for you. I've got The Art of War, written 2,500 years ago by One and Done Sun Tzu.
One and Done.
They actually, I'm sorry, I said it wrong. It's Sun, One, and Done
Tzu. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That is a mouthful.
Also, my translation is in 1910 by a lovely guy named Lionel Giles, who seems like he translated some other things. So he is not a one-hit wonder, but Sun Tzu, what have you done for us lately?
Yeah.
I also want to just call out the name Lionel. There's not enough names that have big cats in them.
Oh, that's right. Great. I was just going to say how much I like that name.
Yeah, it's a good name.
It's great.
It's a very calming name, Lionel.
Lionel, with a lion buried inside.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a Sun Tzu prophecy right there.
Well, I've got a lot of those.
The lion inside. Ian, do you have anything or nah?
Hello, welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And today, Nick, if you're looking for a one-hit wonder, I was going to bring Lisa Jewell's September 2001 book, One Hit Wonder, but then I realized I was misunderstanding the nature of the episode. And so I brought...
That was close.
I know. I would recommend Walter M. Miller Jr.'s award-winning landmark and only novel, A Canticle for Leibovitz, because war never changes.
Is that from Joe's book?
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
I'm trying to remember what book you brought this week, and there's something about that title that I just bounce off. It's like I don't understand a single word in it.
We're going to get into all the words in my title, including A and 4.
I'll just jump right in here and say that I've never even heard of it, so I have to immediately question if this was a hit ever. Is this one moderately successful wonder? What's going on here, Ian? What is this mystery book?
I would say no, it's not.
Follow-up question, how stupid am I?
Well, I do think it's from a time when there were a lot of science fiction novels being written. So it might have gotten lost in the welter. But if you talk to anybody who knows science fiction, this is like 60 years on. 60? My goodness. 60 years on now. It's still regarded as like one of the best science fiction novels ever written. The problem is it's unfilmable. Like you cannot make a movie out of this. And so no one's really interested in doing anything with it. It has not been out of print since it was first published. And given how quickly things kind of fall in and out of print in science fiction publishing, that's pretty amazing.
Hey, Nick, I think Ian might be tricking you a little bit. You know how Ian like sometimes does like those deadpan tricks?
Yeah.
I've read a decent amount of science fiction. I have never heard of this book.
I don't know.
Here we are.
It's a great
book.
And
you're an English teacher, Joe, so that's double concerning.
It is concerning. But no, I'm sure it's totally legit. Ian, we're super excited to hear about your totally real hit.
I am really excited to talk about it. It is, as I was rereading it for the podcast, I realized this is in my top five of all time. Maybe my top three books.
Wow.
I already forgot the title.
I think part of the reason is the title has this rhythm to it, which sounds like just some noises. The title is A Canticle for Leibovitz. And
yeah, it sounds like you dropped a bag of ball bearings down the steps.
It does. Like these two main words, canticle and Leibovitz, each have...
Completely made up.
They have three separate syllables, and they have kind of this bouncing rhythm. And I'm not surprised. But the novel itself is unforgettable, even if the title, apparently to you, uncultured Philistines, is in fact forgettable.
I've forgotten it already.
it's once again gone.
Hey, you know what title is punchy? The Art of War. I mean, talk about naming a book. Yeah, there's a lot of value there. There's a lot of, that's a flashy name.
He just comes at you. He says, listen, this is what we're going to do. I'm gonna talk about art. I'm going to talk about war. That's it.
Yep.
Welcome to You Don't Know Lit, where every week we pick a theme and two books and bicker. For a period of time.
Would you say we squabble? Do we squabble?
I mean, I wouldn't say that, but maybe you or Joe would.
Okay.
No, I think we're very respectful to each other.
I disagree.
Okay, well.
I would respectfully disagree with that. Either rules, or are we just going to keep devolving?
we are waiting patiently.
Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Rule number two, omit needless words, Joe.
Thank
please. Rule number three, winning isn't everything. It's the only thing. And we are going to have a winner today, which is exciting because did you know there was a tie in a football game this football season?
Oh, love it.
No.
A tie. That's disgusting.
That feels un-American.
I think it's awesome. Football. It's like, it's the most exasperating thing. These two groups of burly men clash for, well, it turns out to be a total of, an hour and 15 minutes, and by the end, nothing is decided. That feels like the most American thing of all.
Time has passed, but nothing has changed.
It's very anti-Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu would tell those guys not to enter into that game unless they were sure of victory. So somebody really dropped the ball there.
Joe, you seem eager to start. Why don't you tell me about The Art of War by Old One and Done?
The Art of War, Nick, as you probably know, is the oldest military treatise in the world and, shockingly, maybe relevant all these years later. It is 13 short chapters and contains some of the highest bang-to-your-buck ratio of any book we've discussed here. It was written around 500 BC, and the version that I read was translated and published in 1910, and that publication is in the public domain. So, litheads, free book.
So this is over 100 years old.
It's barely. It ekes past it by 2,400 years.
Joe, are we going to walk away from this episode ready for battle?
You are going to walk away from this episode ready to vanquish your enemies, to... I wish I knew the Conan quote. Enemies fall
what
before
is best
you.
Best in life? To crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and hear the lamentation of the women.
Hey, litheads, that's what you're going to be able to do. Crush your enemies.
Ian.
Yeah.
What book do you have again? Do you want to tell us about it in 30 seconds? If you could just say the name over and over again for 30 seconds, we might remember it.
Have you ever wondered whether the Catholic Church is nuke-proof? In A Canticle for Leibovitz, 320 pages, published 1959, it is. The story focuses on a single Catholic abbey in the American Southwest, which is charged with preserving pre-nuclear apocalypse knowledge. It succeeds over thousands of years and society rebuilds, but we're left wondering whether preserving this knowledge was wise or foolish. A Canticle for Leibovitz, A Canticle for Leibovitz, A Canticle for Leibovitz.
Nick, I had to look up what canticle was just now. It is apparently a hymn or a chant, typically with a biblical text. Is this like when the priest like kind of sings in church, like kind of sings poorly in church? Is that what this is?
Well, sort of.
It is, Joe. Yes. It is.
Yes.
Okay. I've always wondered.
Now you know.
Wait, is it really?
I always wondered what he was up to up there.
Well, it's all kind of, I'm not sure on the specific liturgical definition of a canticle, but it's connected to when the priest does the singing in church. That's the same wavelength for sure. The same ballpark.
Yeah. Like, I feel like the priest always sings like through him, with him, in him, something, 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 Holy
I'm uncomfortable.
Spirit.
Please stop.
Does he sing so something, something, right something? Now. I think you might need to get a new priest. That guy doesn't seem like he knows his stuff.
Blah, 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 blah.
Nick, I'm actually very self-conscious of my singing. If you could auto-tune that for the litheads, I would really appreciate it.
You're already auto-tuned.
Auto-tuned within an inch of our lives.
I think, Joe, I assume we're going to become infinitely wise after your book. So let's become wise first so we can try to understand Ian's title.
Fantastic.
Joseph, what's the art of war?
Teach us, master, the art of war, that we may crush our enemies, see them driven before us, and hear the lamentation of their families.
I guess a little bit about the book itself. It's old. If you ask me how it was written in Chinese by
a
guy named Sun Tzu.
Why did you say it like that? Anyway, Sun Tzu.
Yeah, so Sun Tzu. And Sun Tzu was maybe a real guy, but maybe not. That's kind of the distance in time that we're talking about here. Yeah.
Does this disqualify you from this week's criteria?
Well, okay, so I want to cut this off at the pass because I assume Ian's going to try to cut in and tell me how Sun Tzu isn't even real.
Yeah, no, cool. I didn't know that was a perspective.
Keep it down over there, Ian. We know what you're up to.
Also,
yeah, that's right.
I'll just remind you that we've done like the Odyssey on this show before, and people say Homer wasn't a real person, and we've done Lord of the Rings, and people say Tolkien wasn't a real person. So wait, I would say we don't really care about whether the authors were real or not, and I would never do such a thing.
What's real?
Well,
anyway?
That's good. Well, because that's my take on this. Sun Tzu, this was written in 500 BCE. It seems like maybe Sun Tzu was a famous general of about 100 years prior to this. And it seems like maybe the art of war was kind of this, his collected teachings compiled after his death. So it might, he maybe was a real person, but this also maybe is just a framing device of this fictitious general who was legendarily impressive in battle.
Wait, so he was a teacher or a general?
He was a general. Sun Tzu was a general. There was another guy named Lao Tzu living at the same time who you might know from the Tao Te Ching. He was a teacher, and he was the recorder, founder? I didn't read that book this week. He had something to do with Taoism. He wrote an important book in Taoism.
Is this book just like a bunch of quotes? Because that's what everybody seems to get from this book. You can just quote it and sound really smart. Like if you're on LinkedIn and you're like trying to influence people based on what you believe about business, you would just quote this guy.
Nick, let me answer that with some
with a quote.
Quotes.
Thank God. Is it about Nick, quotes?
It's Nick, if you know the enemy and you know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles.
Wow. Like, subscribe, follow.
Nick, if you appear weak when you are strong and strong when you are weak, you'll be victorious.
It seems like he's trolling us. It seems like it sounds smart at first, but then if you really think about it, you're like, what is he talking about?
It seems like it's just vague enough and just new agey enough not to mean anything.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like nonsense.
It is a little new agey. And I think it's like general. Like it feels like general knowledge. Like Nick, you've heard of truisms, right? Like a truism is this like short, I don't know if it's pithy, but this short saying that you can't really argue with because it's just like this universally accepted truth. Yeah. Like these are things like
let me
it
write
is
one
what
for
it
you
is.
Right.
Yep. Let's hear it.
To love is to think, but to think is not to love.
It is the truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of good fortune must be in want of a wife.
I'm sorry?
So actually, I don't think either of those are examples of truisms, guys. These are things like, it is what it is, or the apple never falls far from the tree.
Okay, right? Sure.
Like, you've heard these things.
Yeah.
So, Nick, I would like to introduce something this week that are not truisms, but suisms.
Oh, suisms. Boy. Okay.
And
spell that for me.
Yeah, so T-Z-U.
Oh, gotcha.
I-S-M. You actually could put a Z in that second part. T-Z-U-I-Z-M. That'd be kind of cool.
Suisms, yeah. Can you work the word facts into it somehow?
You know the rules, Joe. It's not a game unless the word fact is in it somehow.
Rule number 4.
So, you've heard of Sun Tzu because he has survived all these years, kind of unfortunately on the back of MBA students, students who study this in business school, douchebags who put this on the bookshelves in their office.
Let's
right?
call it what it is. They're douchebags.
Yeah, they're douchebags.
If you're
right?
quoting Sun Tzu, you are a rapper or a douchebag.
This is the segment we're alienating today. If you're listening and you like Sun Tzu, well.
No. That's not what we said.
Have I got some bad news?
Well, it is what
you.
We said, but what we meant was if you're posting quotes on Instagram of Sun Tzu, then you're a douchebag.
Yeah. Litheads, he's right.
So Joe,
mm-hmm.
How does this book read? What is this book about? Is this even a book, or is this just a series of like passages and beliefs, or what is this thing?
Yeah, it when you read it, it almost feels. I have a question for both of you. I think this is a line in the sand. Are you the type of people who, growing up, either as children or maybe now, did you keep books in your bathroom or magazines in their bathroom? Was there reading material in your bathroom?
No, there was not.
I'll go ahead and say the same because of what's called the fecal plume, where you flush the toilet. And it just
I was hoping you'd bring this up.
Yeah, it sprays nonsense all over the inside of your bathroom. Just microscopic nonsense, stuff. But nonsense nonetheless. So no, it's a no.
Those
for me,
are poop
dog.
Books. No, we didn't have poop books growing up.
Well, Nick, you've been to my parents' house. Do my parents have poop books?
Several. In every bathroom. There's a poop
baskets
book in every corner of the house.
Baskets full of poop books in their bathrooms. Which, like, let's be real. I'm an English teacher today. I think there might be something to it. However, there's this genre of bathroom literature. You might have seen these like Uncle John's bathroom readers, which are just like these short little passages, kind of these things that are meant to be digestible in the time that you are sitting on the can. Yeah, good.
I love how we're getting, I love the segue that is happening right now. I think I asked you what this book is about and we immediately went to poop books. So I'm on the journey, Joe. Take
Perfect.
Me there. Take me home.
So, there's this genre of literature, Nick, that if you had grown up in a family that had poop books, you would know.
Yeah.
Or PBs, if you've ever visited someone who mm-hmm. reads where they poop.
Perfect.
Who reads in the latrine.
You know what Sun Tzu said is don't poop where you read.
Move swift as the wind, Sun Tzu said, and closely formed as the wood. Attack like the fire and be as still as the mountain. And I'll just cross that one out. I've got 12 more of these to go, guys.
If Joe gets through all three of these before the summer is over, he gets his personal pan pizza.
This book is not written in a narrative style at all. In fact, it is one of the most jarring books that I've ever read. Because on one page, there will be the original Chinese, the translation of the original Chinese, and then directly below it, an extended footnote explaining why the translator made the translation decisions that he did, including references to every previous translation that has ever been made of Sun Tzu's Art of War.
So you got like a scholarly text, a scholarly edition.
Yeah, and this is the famous edition, this Lionel Giles one. This is the one that I think maybe brought it to the English speaking world. And this guy, he was a linguist. He wrote it for his military friends. And it was a book that, I mean, he really popularized it. So I think this is the version of it that many people have read. Although it's been translated and built upon like every public domain book a thousand different times.
I have a question, Thank Joe. You.
Yes, please.
About this. Well, I have two questions. First, I feel like you were starting us into a game and then we sort of breezed past it. So I want to make sure we come back to that. And also, mm-hmm. okay, we've been talking about these losers who basically build their whole identity around how much they
Douchebags.
Love Sun Tzu and the Art of War. Do mm-hmm. you get a sense mm-hmm. that these are proverbs or sayings or recommendations which should be applied to just life in general, like relationships?
Is this a book of worship for douchebags.
It's like, my question is like,
is a douchey biblical Bible?
Is it?
Right. Are these canticles for douchebags?
Well, specifically, like, did you get the sense?
The supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting.
Do you get the sense that these are the kinds of things which can and should be applied in the world at large? Or are they kind of really specific to war fighting and maybe putting them into effect regarding like business is not such a productive plan?
Perfect. I love that question so much. This book has survived because of the applicability, uh-huh. application.
That's right.
That it has to everyday life. Huh. Right. And there are, you know, like if you put yourself in the frame of mind of some competition that you participate in, right? Whether that be chess or football. Tennis or pickleball. If I think that's what Nick just said.
I said football.
Yep, pickleball, thank you. And when you read things like when you think about your tennis game and you think about a quote like...
Are you at a loss for quotes?
Smash the ball hard over to the other side.
What is good in life?
To get points.
But to hit the ball.
So when you think about chess or tennis or whatever sports you litheads are into, mm-hmm. and you think about a quote like, so in war, the way is to avoid what is strong and strike at what is weak. That makes sense. Like you can immediately apply that to your tennis game. Like that is actual tennis advice. That is actual chess advice.
Okay, sure. But like also, Are we gonna lionize Mr. Tzu because mm-hmm. Mr. Sun Tzu because what? He was the first to make the extremely obvious comment that you should not be pitting your strongest forces against the enemy's strength? Like that's like yes. he just got lucky in being the first one to say that.
Well, whoa, lucky. Let me share an example.
Please. Mm-hmm. I wish you would.
Okay. Let me talk you down off your ledge. Mm-hmm. When you go back and listen to the Beatles, they rhyme things like love and dove. Mm. And you look back and it looks really simple, but they were that music back then hasn't really been done before. You know what I mean? They were doing things that haven't been really done before.
Oh, so like, Nick, Ian's about to talk about Shakespeare, just so you know. I just want to warn you right now. Ian is gross. Going to talk about Romeo and Juliet.
I don't know. I guess I don't know. Well, I was going to, Joe, but you took the wind out of my sails. I would say, I guess I understand that, Nick. And maybe part of the reason that it seems so obvious to us today to rhyme love and dove or to say you attack your enemy's weak points is because they've laid the groundwork for us. They've done that. So now, of course, 2,500 years later, we think it's obvious.
Was this the first book to say target your enemy's weak points? Because that one seems obvious.
This is the first book to say a lot of stuff. Many of them are...
Shoot the bad guys.
Yeah. So are these kind of obvious? I think, yes, they are obvious today in many cases. But I think that's also because this is, I mean, it's kind of a foundational text. It's a text that's been around for a long time. It's something that's been taught for a long time. It's something that's been studied for a long time. So is it obvious? Well, sure, but so is the fact that like the sun is at the center of the solar system once somebody teaches you that fact.
Interesting.
Maybe.
We don't have confirmation. We're still getting ballots mm-hmm. in from outlying counties to determine.
Mm-hmm. Very topical. Joe, so this guy's a real one-hit wonder, right? Mm-hmm. Well, why didn't he write more? Does that have anything to do that we just learned that he's a fictional person?
Well, he might be fictional. That might be a reason that he didn't write more.
It's really hard for a fake person to write a sequel.
It also has this feeling. I
think we're cracking the case wide open right now, aren't we?
You know, maybe it's also sort of like a super group, right? Like Cream or something like that, where like they got the band together for this one time, you know, this perfect translator has gotten together for this perfect writer, for this perfect like rememberer of Sun Tzu. And
did
now
you say Cream?
Yeah.
That's Cream. When rock and roll came together for you, Joe. Cream.
We're big Eric Clapton fans.
It's like
fans
the
in
greatest
house.
Band ever created.
Pinnacle of musical entertainment for the last 50 years.
So one of the reasons he's a one-hit wonder is because he maybe didn't exist. Like, that has to be acknowledged. I think the other reasons that he's a one-hit wonder is because he got it right the first time. Like, he just, it was a right. drop the mic moment.
Yeah. You got to know when to walk away.
Also,
Ian,
that, I believe that's
earlier.
A Sun Tzu quote.
Got to know when to walk away.
You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, part of that is actually a Sun Tzu quote.
Really?
Well, the know when you walk away paraphrased.
Sure,
et
of course.
This is one of those books that I think a lot of us know about, but nobody has actually read. Mm. And I think one of the most fun things about reading Sun Tzu is all of the stuff that he talks about that is in no way applicable to the world that we live in. Nice. Because he is not writing general advice. He is writing about war in 500 BCE China.
So it's like when you want to sharpen your bronze spearheads, mm-hmm. take them to the stone on the north side of the river.
Yeah, you've captured the spirit exactly, right? Like, there's an extensive chapter about using fire arrows in battle and all the different ways that fire can be employed.
To be fair, we haven't tried that much recently, and maybe we should go back to it.
Yeah, I tried doing that. I was negotiating a pay raise, and I lit his office on fire, but it did not go well.
There's a whole section of a chapter talking about how many horses we need to maintain our supply lines. There is a chapter, honest to God, one of the 13 chapters is about the 9 different types of terrain that you might fight war upon.
Nice.
So that stuff doesn't get quoted this much.
I want to start quoting those.
I'm thinking... What an excellent troll to say, what's your favorite part of the Art of War? And give them this very serious sounding citation.
Lay waste to the desert.
And then it goes to, you may also be called upon to fight on sand. For this, give your horses little cages around their hooves so they don't sink in.
So yeah, you've nailed it. Like, you have absolutely caught the rhythm of what so much of this book is. So is this book kind of cool and interesting? Sure. Is it like fun to read? I think it's worth reading because like nobody else has read it and it makes you feel smarter than them, which I think is worthwhile.
How much am I of a question?
Yep.
How much of this is usable information and how much is just about actual war? Is this one of the most misquoted books ever?
I don't think it's one of the misquoted books ever. I think it's probably 70-30, maybe 65-35.
It's so much more than I thought.
Okay, I have exactly one more thing to say about this, and I think it's just like the most interesting piece of history about Art of War.
Oh, great, great. I'm ready.
Okay.
And so is Ian,
so,
I think.
I am ready.
At the time this was written, it is at a time when China is just full of feudal states. Like, they are these small principalities ruled by local governors, by local barons, etc. And they were at war all the time, like just absolutely at war. And when this was written, China was in chaos. The armies were led by not generals, but like aristocrats and knights who were raised to look up to their ancestors. And there was no higher goal than like in their lives than to end up in an epic poem by slaughtering a bunch of their enemies and hopefully well-known enemies.
Sounds kind of like they wanted to go viral and get 1.2 million followers on TikTok.
Perfect.
It's almost as if the more divided we are, the more wars there are. Fascinating.
Wait, so Nick, these sound like the kind of lily-livered nincompoops who would really appreciate a manual which says, listen, there is marsh and there is plain and there is mountain. And they fight differently. Like, it sounds like this might have been very applicable to their needs.
My concern is that two enemies would be reading this exact same book. And like a mirror be just doing the exact same thing. Page 42, yeah! You know, page 27, yeah!
Go!
And then they're just completely
wrap those horses' hooves!
Yeah.
One of the reasons it's thought is it wasn't for those little principalities. It wasn't for those dukes. It wasn't for those barons. But it was for the larger rulers in the land. And the message was kind of, hey, buddy, war is super important in your country. It's a matter of life and death. It costs a ton of money. It should be waged only if it's profitable. Are you sure you want to leave it to these, like, these dukes, these barons, these idiots? Don't you think war should be led by the professionals? Mm. And one of these things, it was kind of this sales pitch for professional generals, like professional war fighters to come in. And one of the themes, and I should have maybe led with this, but one of the themes of Art of War is, hey, the best way to obtain a victory is to not fight at all.
Huh.
And I think that's super interesting. And a ton of the early chapters in this especially are about like understanding your strength, understanding your enemy's strength, and winning this fight before you ever set foot on a battlefield.
I got one last question for you, Joe.
Yep, absolutely.
One quick question.
Yes.
War bad? War good, war bad?
I think Sun Tzu would
say
that.
What would he say?
He would say that war is necessary.
Mm.
That's where he would start. He would say, look, war is going to happen. It is up to you to be perfectly prepared for war and engage your enemy on your terms, not theirs.
All this Sun Tzu talk is making me think that when we finally write Too Many Butlers, our book that we've been working on, our spy thriller about the butler who...
Wait, spy thriller?
Yeah.
No, well, butler thriller.
Mystery. Mystery.
Oh, it's genre-defining is what you're saying, Joe.
Too Many Sue Butlers.
It's the first genre... Sun it's the first book of it genre, the butler genre. In their breakthrough role as butler writers. All this Sun Tzu talk is really making me think that we should come up with a fake name for all the three of us.
Oh, sure.
And then it leads me to this next question. Our main character's name is Jeff Jeeves.
Oh, but wait, I think I know where you're going.
Could the author of the book also be the star of the book? Could this be written by Jeff Jeeves? Could that be our pseudonym?
Oh, Jeff Jeeves.
It's very meta. Has that ever been done before?
Probably. Sorry to take the wind out of your sails, but fuck! I mean, Nick, I will say this. No one has ever taken Jeff Jeeves as a pseudonym because I Googled it frantically for about 15 seconds and I didn't really find anything. So,
okay, well, then we're good.
We're groundbreaking.
It up.
Nick, there's actually one thing I should have said at the very beginning.
Oh, he's trying to add another fucking thing. Here we go.
No, I think you'll like this thing.
Just one more thing. You're like Columbo. All right.
The Art of War, Nick, you'll appreciate this. This is a listener recommendation.
Oh,
this one actually led with this.
Yeah,
this
you should have led with that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It comes from listener Chris.
Boy, Chris, I would have prioritized you, Chris.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, he also said that it has led to him winning many, many games of Risk since then.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Congratulations, Chris.
On March 2nd, it's Dr. Seuss's birthday, so I have a question for you. Was he a real doctor, or was he a doctor like Ian is a doctor? Was he like working around patients? Do you guys know? You guys are teachers, you should know this.
I think I would need to research that, but I kind of think he maybe was.
Like a surgeon?
Yeah, maybe he was like cutting people up, but like rhyming as he did so. Like, I do believe you have a broken bone, and that's the reason that I'm reaching for this phone.
Oh,
very good.
Because he's going to call the nurse and say he has a broken bone.
Right, because of the bone. Maybe while you prepare, you could also read a Dr. Seuss book and then bring it to me?
That sounds sure. Yes. That sounds short.
While you do your research,
I'm in. Okay, I'll do the research, and then in honor of his passing, I will read The Lorax, which is a good book by Dr. Seuss. Maybe not a doctor.
Quote unquote Dr. Seuss.
Okay, so Litheads, this week I will, of course, be bringing, in honor of my godson Harrison, Hop on Pop. And yeah, I might change it.
All right.
So my tentative commitment is Hop on Pop.
Ian.
Hey.
Dr. Ian DeYoung.
Yep.
Paging Dr. Ian DeYoung.
That's me.
Can you tell me about your book?
I will. Okay. So this is, I realized as I was preparing this book that this is, in fact, one of my favorite books, and I'm super excited to talk about it. It's mesmerizing. And it's very, very difficult to boil down. On the plus side, it's also really hard to spoil. So I'm going to start with a game. So this game is, you guys may be familiar with it. It's a little something I like to call Would You Rather.
Ian, when I've played this game in the past, it's been like kind of dirty. It like skews towards like a little bit naughty.
No, it's not really. I would say this is not naughty. It's just brutally violent. So your two options, would you rather, I put it in the chat so you can look at it that way, but I'll also say it out loud because our readers are not privy to our chat. Would you rather travel hundreds of miles across a dangerous wasteland only to discover that all of your cutting-edge scientific discoveries were made 1,000 years ago? Or spend 20 years hand-copying a blueprint you didn't understand only to have it stolen by mutant bandits?
This is specific.
It is. It's very specific. But these are your options. You can either travel hundreds of miles across a dangerous wasteland to discover that all of your cutting-edge scientific discoveries were made 1,000 years ago, or you can spend 20 years hand-copying a blueprint you didn't understand only to have it stolen by mutant bandits.
Now, you say when all of your cutting-edge scientific discoveries, am I the one who discovered them?
Yes.
Well, or is it humanity?
So in this scenario, you go across this dangerous wasteland with a mind full of discoveries that you think you've made. And then when you get to your destination, you discover, no, they came up with this and they did it better than I could possibly do it 1,000 years ago.
I think that would be deflating.
That is pretty deflating. Yep.
First one. At least you're getting exercise in the first one. The second one is like, you're getting carpal tunnel and you're going to be real upset after 20 years.
I would rather go for a nature walk, even if it's across the wasteland, than sit in an office for 20 years copying a blueprint. I agree with Nick. I think I would rather have my life's work diminished. Mm-hmm.
To be clear, the process of copying is art, and you enjoy that part of it.
Oh.
How much do I enjoy it?
I mean, you feel like this is one of the things you're called to do. You're really good at making this art, and it's really beautiful when you're done with it. So,
well, you didn't say it was going to be our
raison
d'etre.
Yeah, you didn't say any of that important information.
Well, you're supposed to ask, right in the chat it says, you guys can discuss it. So this is where we're discussing it, and I'm filling you in.
Then I'll get your decisions, and we'll crown a winner. I'm ready I'm ready to win. Ian, what do I have to do to win? The second one, is that the right choice?
If you guys have finished discussing.
Hey, Joe, does it seem like he wants you to choose the second one, or is that just me?
Nick, in the spirit of Sun Tzu, I am letting my plans be as dark and impenetrable as the night, and I will be falling like a thunderbolt in a moment here. So I'd rather not say.
Go ahead, Nick.
I'd still rather go on a walk.
Okay. And Joe?
I'm going to take this opportunity to introduce a new literary term to Nick. This is, of course, the raison d'etre, which is your reason for being. And if art is my reason for being, I am going to choose number two. And if nothing else, those 20 years were not wasted because I am a better person for them.
Right.
Thunderbolt. Okay.
Well, you guys are both winners because you're wiser after these experiences, but you're both losers because all of your hard work has been kind of torn up. So I guess the real winner here is the Litheads that they got to hear.
They don't
sound
like, I don't think they're winning.
Congratulations, Litheads.
Great job again, Litheads. You get the crown.
We're a winning streak going. These are two things that happen in this book, among a bunch of other stuff. And this book is just a precious gem. It's just beautiful. It does that thing. Joe, you mentioned slapstick several years ago now,
mm-hmm.
Where the USA is broken up into warring factions. And there's like the Duke of Fargo.
Yeah, like the Duke of Michigan. Yeah, love it.
King of Staten Island.
This, yeah, the King of Staten Island. this book does that, which is just a blast. Like anytime you've got an emperor wannabe styling himself High Vaquero of the Plains.
Yep.
That's pretty great. It's pretty funny.
Ian?
Yeah.
Now, granted, that was hands down the worst game I've ever played in my life. But
it's okay.
I don't know. Have you ever played Risk? That was a game mentioned earlier, and that is a very fun game.
We should play Risk it for days. On this podcast.
Oh, that would be riveting. It's unbearable playing of a game of Risk, let alone listening to somebody play.
Brutal.
We could just record the moves, not the gaping silence.
I've never actually played Risk.
Well, maybe for our first live show.
There we go. That's what the lit heads have come for.
Yeah, it'll be like a an all-nighter.
Yep.
It'll be like a filibuster. It'll
the
just
lit heads are
going.
Just
going
to be filtering out of the back room of the library that we've served.
Podcast makes its debut in first 36 hour show.
Just slowly leaving one by one.
We'll get the Guinness World Record though. That'll be nice.
Hey Ian, what's this book about?
So, okay. It takes place. It's got these three sections and they all sort of center around
like Joe's
this,
book.
Yeah, perhaps. Except for there's a lot of difference. Both books are really interested in war, I think. But this book maybe even takes a much more pessimistic view of war than Joe's book does. I think Joe's book would say that war can be won. And this book would say there is no such thing as winning war. Everyone always loses. When there is war, people lose. So the book takes place. It has these three kind of movements. And the movements are set over the course of about 2,000 years. And the first movement is... it's a certain amount of time. It's a few centuries after the nuclear apocalypse, which they refer to as the flame deluge.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Miller is really good at names. He's really good at coming up with names for things. So after the flame deluge, there was this this period called the simplification, where people thought, well, our intellect got us to this place, so we're going to destroy all knowledge. We're going to burn books. We're going to just get rid of all the knowledge that exists. And there is this one guy who took it upon himself to preserve as many books and pieces of knowledge as he could. And he protected them and he saved them. And then there grew up around kind of his collection, this Catholic abbey. So the story takes place at three different points in the history of the abbey. Shortly, like a couple centuries after the flame deluge, and then kind of as society starts to rebuild itself, and then in the year 3700, things are back to where they were before. So we have spaceships, we have nukes again, and the abbey is like, well, what do we do now? And
I have a question. There's a book, I don't want to say it's a similar premise, but you could see it. The Book of Eli, the movie. This is going to be a confusing sentence, but it's a movie, but it's called The Book of Eli. Now I understand that's confusing on a literature podcast, but
got it.
Are you tracking?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think my sense of the Book of Eli is
the movie The Book of Eli.
The movie. Yeah. The movie is that it has a similar concern with protecting knowledge, and it's also interestingly enough got kind of a religious or spiritual bent to it, which we can hopefully talk about at some point soon. But
hopefully.
I would say the difference is that in the Book of Eli, it's very, very unclear or uncertain whether or not like Denzel Washington, the book he brings in his mind will actually be, whether it'll change anything, whether like the world will change. In this story, we get to see first, the first section is the big event is people are discovering
a new treasure trove of documents and like, oh, cool, now we can help preserve knowledge better. In the second passage, people are deciphering them. In the third one, they're deciding, like, what do we do now that we're back to the brink of nuclear war? So I feel like the Book of Eli is like, well, knowledge is good. And this book is kind of like, sure, we can save knowledge. We can save, like, our intellectual product, but it's not maybe actually a necessarily a positive thing because nukes.
Is this book fun?
Or heroin?
I would say this is the thing.
Is this a downer?
No, this is the, okay. So it's a really weird, because I would say the message is challenging and the themes are harrowing, but it's told with this wry sense of humor. Okay. And the ending is so unexpectedly hopeful that I can't say it's a downer. Like,
that's
it's not an unmitigated, like, they all lived happily ever after. Chewbacca doesn't get a medal, but everyone else gets a medal. And the spaceship flies off into the sun. It's like,
it explodes.
Things like you.
It's a little different than a boat sailing off into the sun, isn't it? A spaceship flying into the sun.
Kind of the sun that's bad.
Yeah, different meaning.
This book, it's not like unmitigated positive, but I would say it's on the whole, it's hopeful. And that's very, very strange because of the events that happen towards the end of the book. You're surprised that it's not just completely grim.
Yeah, for post-apocalyptic science fiction, yeah, I'd say hopeful is a weird tone. But that's lovely.
So tell me about the author. Is he a real person?
Good question.
Or yes. A fake person like Joe's one-hit wonder?
Yeah.
We think.
The author's
we don't
a real
know.
Person. And the author, I think the author is, I'm not always a big fan of bringing author's biography into sort of how we interpret a text. But I think in this case, it's really useful. So
I love doing it. Was he a racist?
No.
Probably.
No. No. For actually, I can't say no because I didn't meet him in person. His stories aren't racist, so that's good.
I can only rule out if somebody's racist unless I meet them.
Well, I can't say in person he might have been dreadful. I will just say, like, his books are his stories in his book is not. So yeah. He flew in airplanes in World War II, and he participated in a battle in Italy called the Battle of Monte Cassino. And in the battle of Monte Cassino, the Allies blew up the oldest monastery in Europe.
That's sad.
It was
that
really sad.
Sounds right.
It was a really, researching this is a really weird kind of juxtaposition, because the Nazis are the ones who are saying, hey, the Allies are probably going to destroy this building. Let's get all of the old books and treasures out. And the Allies were like, blow it up. And then they did. So that was disappointing.
Yeah. Sounds like the Nazis had their heart in the right place.
Oh, God.
Well, they're probably going to try and pilfer that stuff anyway. But the point is, Walter Miller, our author, Walter Miller Jr., he was there and he participated in this battle, and he hated it. He thought it was dreadful. And he kind of got involved in anti-war activism through the 1950s. But he wrote some science fiction stories in the 50s. And then he wrote this novel. It was published in 59. Mm-hmm. It won the Hugo Award in 1961. And then he never wrote anything else.
Oh, boy.
No more short stories. No more long fiction. Not even any more, like, nonfiction. He became a recluse. He
how
didn't
old
talk
is
to his
he?
Agent.
I was going to say. How old is he when this was published? You said he served in the war. He must have been, what, 40s?
Yeah. Born yeah, he wasn't too old. He was... dates right now. Yeah, he was about 50. Sorry, he was about 35, 36 when this came out. Huh. When the book came out.
You know, to be fair, I thought this book was written much earlier than that. Just to clarify my racist question. I thought this is a much older book.
People from the 1950s can be racist too.
That's of course true, but you have to understand, litheads, most books that are written 100 years ago were written by terrible, terrible people.
Yeah.
This is monsters.
This is a strange moment because I think I may have, for the first time, brought a book which is newer than Joe's book.
Oh, my book's pretty old.
Yeah. It seems on point. So in 1996, he took his own life, and he had the notes for a sequel to this book. It had been 40 years since he'd published anything. He had notes for a sequel,
but one hit wonder.
Killed himself, Ian.
Well, 40 years later.
Well, so but Nick, he had plenty of opportunity to write something. I honestly think kind of the situation was he was maybe a victim of his own success. He wrote these short stories and people liked them a lot. And then he wrote this novel and people were pretty quickly, within like 10 years, saying, this is one of the best science fiction novels ever written. Wow. This is a classic. It had mainstream success beyond the sort of sci-fi thing. And he may have kind of gotten frozen because he had these notes for this book, this sequel, this follow-up, and it 40 years later,
no, you can't follow it up.
Published posthumously.
How do you follow that up? That would be so overwhelming for just like, I mean, realistically, probably a pretty normal person, right?
He
wasn't like a full-time writer his whole life necessarily.
He had PTSD from the war. Undiagnosed PTSD, so he's dealing with that. And
did he actually have that?
Yeah.
Or are you just assuming that might have been a factor?
No, no. People who knew him, he had like one or two friends who kind of stayed close to him, and they said he totally had PTSD, but they didn't they didn't diagnose
him. Yeah.
Sure.
So he wrote this first book, The Canticle for Leibowitz. I guess his only book, and then he had this posthumous book. Like, surely he learned from his title, right? Like, surely the posthumous book had like a very normal title, like not something that was weird. Right, Ian?
Leading Your Honor.
The second book is called Saint Leibowitz and the Wild Horse Woman. So
I love it.
Marginally better, I would say. But
well, horse woman, that's catchy.
It evokes the imagination, doesn't it?
It does. Mm-hmm. It does.
Bottom half, top half, right, left.
All right, calm yourself.
It's always usually the top or the bottom, like you know, like these two like these mixed things. Yeah, it's never like right and left.
Can I talk to you
really
guys?
Weird.
Nick, you talk a lot about racists on this episode, but I mean, when horse people, half horse people, when centaurs take over the planet, they are not going to look favorably on your comments disparaging horse women. So let's just all relax.
It's all relative, isn't it? Ian, do you have any more information?
I have so much. You guys have really talked over me, and I've got a lot to go, but I don't have much time. So instead, I'll just drop in one thing that I don't have time for, the phrase monastic space goers. This is all about monks who go to space, which is kind of cool.
I love that.
We don't have time to talk about that. Instead, let's talk about the idea of recurrence. boo.
boo. No, fuck
boo
that. Boo out of here, the
with
monk.
Me, Joe.
Monks.
Friedrich
right,
tell
Nietzsche, us about recurrence, Ian.
Friedrich Nietzsche, who had a great mustache, said there is the possibility that human nature will repeat the same actions over and over again. We can't really break free of our natures, and that this is a good thing. This is positive. So, like, we are stuck. Like, human beings can't really make progress, possibly, according to Nietzsche, and that's fine. Arthur Schopenhauer, who had wonderful sideburns but not a great mustache, agreed with Nietzsche about the whole recurrence thing.
But he said
that it was actually a bummer. So we should be pessimistic about, like, we're stuck in a rut, we're not improving, that kind of thing. Just out of curiosity, where do you guys fall on this question? Like, are human beings like gradually getting our crap together, or are we, in fact, kind of just repeating the same mistakes over and over?
Joe, I'm going to need you to answer as Sun Tzu.
If you would like me to answer as Sun Tzu, I'm going to have to go second.
He's finding a quote.
Was Sun Tzu a pretty positive guy?
You know, Sun Tzu would say that opportunities multiply as they are seized. So Sun Tzu, I think, would say that we are moving forward as a species. As we seize a new opportunity, as we seize something else, more opportunities present themselves, which kind of mirrors itself in the history of like science and technology, I think would show that.
Yeah. Ian, we're going to go Sun Tzu as our final answer.
Okay. You guys each get 500 points, but there will be a penalty at the end of the episode if you're wrong. So this book would disagree with Sun Tzu. This book would say we are we are walking through a cycle of recurrence. So there is from the nuclear, from the apocalypse to the simplification, overreaction, destroy all knowledge, to the preservation of the knowledge, to deciphering the knowledge, to weaponizing that knowledge. This is kind of the idea that we have gotten ourselves to the brink of nuclear war before, and left alone, we will just do the same thing again. Like, we will not break out of this rut. And maybe science and technology are always increasing, but that doesn't mean human beings are getting any better. The impulse to nuke other people might always still be there. So this is directly opposed to another philosophical concept called teleology, which is this idea that humanity is just always ramping, evolving into its best self. So you've got recurrence, we're just stuck in a rut, versus teleology, we're always ramping towards brilliance and kind of being our best possible selves. I'm not sure philosophically where I stand, and recurrence is a huge bummer, but something about this book feels true. Like, if there were a nuclear apocalypse and we did develop the means to make nukes again, there would be another nuclear apocalypse.
Yeah. Oh, it's so stressful. So like when you asked that question, ever since you asked that question, when I was fishing for the Sun Tzu quote, I've just had this feeling of dread in my stomach, right? Because like when you ask, I mean, do we repeat ourselves, right? Like, are we destined to make the same mistakes over and over again? Or I guess the same cyclical behavior. Everything about me wants to say no, but my heart feels like that's not the right answer.
Right. It's a bummer. If recurrence is like the course of human history, this is how it would play out. And it's a huge bummer. The positive is with a lot of stories like this, Miller doesn't necessarily say it can only always end up this way. It might end up better. The next round might be better.
It's like when they say, when people are like, well, statistically, this is the most peaceful time in human history. It's like, well, it does not feel that way. Are you sure about these numbers? Can you run them again?
It also reminds me of one of the Matrix sequels. I don't know if it's the second one or the third one. Yeah.
Oh, the third one. I think it's... Yeah.
The third one, when like he's in the room, when he's in the room with all of the TV monitors and he's talking about like all the possible futures, that's what that makes me
think
of.
With Sean Connery.
Like, Matrix 3, Sean Connery, famous film.
Have you told us what this book is about?
I have Nuke Proof written on my notes, so I think that's what it's
about. Besides
the
apocalypse, are there characters, or is this more just like describing the apocalypse?
Yeah. So each passage, there are the three sections, and the first section, it takes place at the abbey. So there are like monks and abbots and bishops and stuff who interact.
Downtown Abbey?
No, it's not the downtown abbey. It's kind of more of a rural abbey. And it's more about like, will human beings use knowledge in an ethical way and avoid nuclear holocaust for the second time?
Oh, no. Yeah. The answer is no. I do have one more question for you, Ian. What is the name of this book?
You should read A Canticle for Leibovitz because it is full of secret learning. It exercises your brain while giving you a funny, well-written adventure story. And there are people with two heads in it.
I love secret learning.
Well, that's pretty good. Sounds like you should have led with that part.
In order to pick a winner this week, I have a philosophical question that you both have to answer.
Oh, boy.
Are you ready? We covered a lot of philosophy this past several minutes. It
has been
philosophical. So, if a person does not finish a book, should they be allowed to leave a one-star review?
If a person does not finish a book, should they be allowed to leave a one-star review?
Should they be allowed to leave a one-star review?
They
didn't finish. How can they properly judge it?
Yeah,
or
it's
was
tough
it
to
so
say.
Bad that they could not finish?
I frequently tell my students that if they are not enjoying a book, right? Not a course book, but like a choice book that they read, they should get rid of it, right? If you are not enjoying that book,
sure.
Switch it, right? Switch it out. Like reading is not a punishment. Reading is meant to be enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, I am, for a future episode, Litheads, a little sneak peek, I am reading Dune right now. I have tried to read Dune several times in my life and have bounced off of it. This time, I don't know what has changed in my life. If I've just got far enough into it, I absolutely cannot put it down. Mm. If I would have reviewed this book when I was 20 years old, I would have left a 1-star review for it. If I reviewed it right now, I would leave a 5-star review for it. So I'm going to settle on the side, Nick, that You cannot. I'm gonna be decisive here. Mm-hmm. You cannot leave a one-star review if you do not read the book.
Mm, alienating them. I love it, Ian. Mm-hmm.
I would say that.
Are you gonna be contrary right now?
What's that?
Are you gonna be contrary, or are you gonna?
I'm gonna agree. I would say that. Yeah. I would say that one star is a qualitative judgment. It's saying this thing. I have consumed it and I judge it to be worth one star. I am ranking it at that level.
Yeah. How can you leave a review if you didn't finish?
There is a difference between DNF, did not finish, and this book is objectively bad. So what I would say, Nick, is I would say that whatever website you're looking at, Goodreads or whatever, sure, maybe prohibit them, however that works. Don't let people who haven't finished the book leave a one star review. But also keep track of DNFs.
Yes, I think that's a fantastic
because, like,
idea.
I would love it. There are so many books I would love to be able to say, hey, I didn't finish this. That is, I think, an indictment of quality without saying, like, it is the objectively all.
So
bad.
There should because be a separate category for
the people who
did not finish.
The people who leave five-star
did
reviews.
Did not finish. Five stars. They should be leaving five-star reviews. They just saved so much time by not finishing
this
book.
To be fair, if there was a did not finish five stars, that's all that The Art of War would have next to it.
Yes.
I don't know who should win today. I think, I don't think I'd ever read The Art of War. It seems like I'd mostly learn about horses. So
there's some horse talk.
But. Mm. I don't know what Ian's book is called. So I would never even be able to find it if I decided it won. So congratulations, Joe.
Thank you.
Ian, before we get to finally hear another a quote from Joe's book, can you talk to the litheads for me?
Litheads, you trust me, right? I think you do. Don't answer that. If you'd like to have one of your favorite books, or heck, one of your least favorite books featured on this podcast, head on over to our website, youdontknowlitpodcast.com, and click on a button that says submit a book and force us to dance for you, by which I mean recommend a book for us to read. If you have not, please head on over to the iTunes Apple Store. Still don't think I'm saying that name of that place right, because I'm an Android boy. Give us a 5-star rating and leave us a review too, if you don't mind. If you have done so, tell us to a friend. Talk to a friend about us. Tell about us to a friend. I have no more words because the podcast is over.
The Android boy is breaking down.
I have sand in my gears. There's a snake in my boot. Mm-hmm. Goodbye.
I have actually. Out of all the quotes that I've read, I this is actually my favorite, and I've saved it for last in a moment of hubris, perhaps thinking that maybe I would have the chance to win this episode.
Wait, does Sun Tzu have anything to say about hubris?
Yeah, he's against it. like everybody. This is a general strategy advice, I guess, but I thought he made a really interesting observation in this. It's a little more poetic than much of his language is. So Sun Tzu says, there are not more than 5 musical notes, but the combinations of all of these 5 give rise to more melodies than can ever be heard. There are not more than 5 primary colors, yet in combination they produce more hues than can ever be seen. There are not more than 5 cardinal tastes, sour, acid, salt, sweet, and bitter, yet combinations of them yield more flavors than can ever be tasted. In battle, there are not more than 2 methods of attack, the direct and the indirect. Yet those 2 in combination give rise to an endless series of maneuvers. The direct and indirect can lead on to another turn. It's like moving in a circle. You never come to an end. Who can exhaust the possibilities of their combination?